Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:33 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is Friday, so it's the Big Picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes on February 11th. Well, I thought we'd kick off with the Nasdaq. It was down another couple of percent today, but I think more importantly than that, it's encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. So this qualifies as the beginning of a first step below the peak. And generally speaking, after a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, you get a rebound because the speed of the decline shocks people. And people's response to the shock is twofold. The first is going to be, well, how much has really changed? Have we really changed the outlook for some of the best performing companies in the world? They're still great companies. And then you had their really impressive earnings coming through for the fourth quarter and cloud doing spectacularly well and people saying, well, nothing's changed. So this is a buy. And every time we've had a pullback in the past, it's a buy. And that helped the market to rebound for a couple of weeks. But the other side of the argument is that some people will have had been stopped out. And they'll be looking at interest rates and they'll be thinking, well, golly, it went up an awful lot in the last couple of years, so maybe we'll just wait and see what happens next. And of course, when that happens, then that removes a source of demand from the market. And when people stop buying, then it throws the onus for supporting the rally onto an increasingly small number of people. And then when you start to see relative underperformance, then it also withdraws an additional source of liquidity and demand from the market. So it becomes progressively more difficult for it to be able to sustain a rally. And then against all of that background, we have what's going on in terms of interest rates. So all the way through 2021, the Federal Reserve was sticking to its guns and saying that inflation is transitory. And because they weren't expressing any real fear at the threat of inflation, then stock markets didn't either. But what's happening now is that investors are looking at the Fed potentially panicking at the continued rise in inflation, and then that's engendering fear in other investors as well. So there's a cascade effect because people are thinking, well, I don't think perhaps that the Federal Reserve is going to aggressively raise interest rates, but other people think that it is. And if other people think that and they're going to sell, well, then maybe the market would pull back on that news. So maybe I should sell now instead. So there is that type of contagion activity. But one thing that I think is another way of thinking about the market is that from the perspective of the Federal Reserve, they moved with alacrity to really pour money into the system in 2020. And the Nasdaq went from 7,000 to over 16,000 in the space of about a year and a half. So that was a profound advance. And along the way, they got inflation. So they rescued the economy. Now we're back at almost full employment. Obviously, the participation rate isn't at the same place today as it was back in 2019, but it's very questionable whether interest rates can do anything about that. And we have a recovery that has been much quicker than after other recessions. So the Federal Reserve can take some credit for the fact that they've created a recovery, but that now there's an inflationary problem that has to be addressed. And the easy way of thinking about it from their perspective is, well, if they start withdrawing the liquidity, if we got back to the pre-pandemic stage of the economy with the same participation rate, the same unemployment rate, and then the same growth rate, wouldn't that be wonderful? But from a stock market perspective, that would mean pulling back to the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And The 1,000-day moving average is the lodestone for major bull markets. And that's why it's really quite important to look at the log scale charts, because these are important from the perspective of unlevered investors. So as we look at the at this very long-term chart, and I'm going to put it onto a weekly basis so that we'll get the 1,000-day moving average, we can see clearly that from a log scale perspective, during medium-term corrections, it comes back to approximate it. And this is another medium-term correction. And the 1,000-day moving average isn't far off coinciding with the peaks from all the way back in early 2020. And it wouldn't be at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we see the price come back into that area. And we also have the experience of 2018. The Federal Reserve wasn't worried about a 10% pullback at the beginning of the year. And we did have a 10% pullback, and it was right around the time that Jay Powell was given his job, and markets were worried about that, about the new face at the press conferences. And all the way through 2018, they were raising rates and reducing the size of their balance sheet. And the market struggled to get up to a new high. And right around August, September, it started to pull back. And by the time we got to December, it had pulled back by 20%. And in no uncertain terms, the plunge protection team was called upon. And Steve Mnuchin had a big meeting with all the CEOs of the Wall Street firms, and in January the Federal Reserve started cutting interest rates, and the market recovered so that by the time we got around to May of 2019, we were at a new high. So this is also potentially what we're looking at now. We're likely to see continued downward pressure on stocks until the Federal Reserve relents and stops talking about raising interest rates in an aggressive manner. And of course, we've had a really significant jump in bond yields over the course of the last week, and we got all the way up to test the 2% level. And we're seeing a little bit of resistance coming in right now in the form of a pause around this psychological 2% level. And a lot of that has to do with an additional catalyst in the form of what's going on with Europe, Ukraine, and Russia. So the CRTX in Russia rebounded along with everything else, and then started giving up that advance in here today. And you have the Biden administration talking about the possibility that Russia will not wait until the end of the Olympics to invade Ukraine. And I think there were parallels I saw on social media posts last night talking about Russia using the Olympics as a timing tool for invasions, because they invaded Crimea 4 years ago, or 2 years ago, excuse me, during the Olympics as well. So there's a lot of fear around what exactly is going on. And of course, Russia probably feels in a rather privileged position because of natural gas prices. And natural gas has been easing off over the course of the last month because of warmer weather. But it's continuing to hold the breakout. And the price right now at 185 is still multiple of where it was at the beginning of 2021. And there's the realistic possibility that prices can sustain this breakout. And if Russia does invade Ukraine, well, what is Europe really going to do about it? And are they going to stop buying Russian gas? They may obviously decide that they're going to penalize Russian officials. And of course, the Russian response to that could be to simply turn the gas off. Because one thing that is also clear is gas for Russia is a significant export, but it comes nowhere close to the importance of oil. So it's a geopolitical tool from their perspective, and it's something that they might be able to lose in terms of revenue because they know that eventually the gas will have to be turned back on because Europe in particular can't do without it, and they're about to double their exports of gas to China. That's of course going to create the same web of interdependence between Russia and China that there already exists between Russia and Europe, but that's obviously not going to be an issue in the short term. It's obviously sowing the seeds for geopolitical tensions in the future, but that's not something that is really disturbing markets at present. So one thing that we can then think about is I think it's more important to keep an eye on the currency. So the ruble did weaken in here today. So we've got the dollar bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average. And that was a dynamic move in here today. So certainly some risk getting taken off the table with regard to Russia on at least deciding to try and sell first before war in fact does break out. But I think it's still very questionable whether war will in fact break out and whether this isn't simply brinksmanship. It's not in Russia's interests to attract even more in the way of sanctions and difficulties with trading with the rest of the world. So it's certainly not baked in the pie just yet that there is going to be a war. But, and of course, if the currency continues to deteriorate, but most particularly if it were breaking down to new lows, then I think that would be a clear market signal that there is a willingness by investors to price in the potential that there will be a war. But Russian assets are selling off aggressively. So we certainly know that Russia is a major commodity exporter. So I guess there's two ways of looking at it. There's certainly the kind of pullback we've seen, for example, in Norilsk Nickel. And it's the biggest producer of nickel and also palladium. The share pulled back violently this week, and there's been a succession of lower rally highs for most of the last year, and it's pausing in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and it's bounced from that area on every occasion over the last 4 years. So it is interesting as to whether this is going to continue to be the case. Certainly, going to create a value opportunity in the event that sanctions are imposed in or on Russia. Well, then it's going to improve the marketability of nickel resources from other sectors. So Brazil is potentially a significant beneficiary. Vale is a major nickel producer, and particularly following its acquisition of Inco over a decade ago. But it also is, I think, interesting in when we think about Petrobras. So when we think about Russia's big export, it's oil. And if sanctions are imposed, well, then that's going to improve the marketability of other sources of supply. So Petrobras has been in this base formation, and it's been an exceptionally volatile base formation for 7 years. And it's coming back up now towards the $15 area and certainly rallying in here today. And the 12-month yield is almost 15%. And they've had a return of capital in November, but they've been growing the dividend aggressively over the last 3 years. They've been cutting back on their debt. So this is, and they've also, I think, which is something that hasn't been publicized effectively by them, they've cut the cost of production in the ultra deep pre-salt to above $30. So when prices are 90, that's a really attractive prospect. And oil prices surged today. They were up nearly $3. So we're certainly seeing greater interest in physical resources and much less interest right now in anything that doesn't attract real hard cash flows. So oil prices up $3.50. This is obviously a clear reassertion of the short-term trend, and it looks increasingly likely that we may see the $100 area by the end of next week. And that's going to be a rather psychological event. Excuse me, I must sneeze. Excuse me. When we go back and look at the fact that $100 offered support between about 2011 and 2014, and since then we haven't seen prices above it. If prices get back up above $100, a great deal of additional new supply is going to become economic. But in the oil market, it's not just about being economic, because companies are being faced with non-economic obstacles to increasing supply. There's tends to be a media whirlwind around any kind of measure announced to increase supply. So OPEC are in a charmed environment because they're making more money without, in fact, pumping much more oil. So that's rather beneficial. And quite a few companies have found that they've been in this situation for most of the last year. You have Mercedes that the price increases that they've been able to pass on to customers have more than made up for the fact that they're producing fewer cars. So they must feel like they're in a charmed position as well. And then we can think about life insurers. They've been talking about higher mortality rates in the poor white community of the USA for 5 years already. And now they're saying, well, mortality rates have climbed even higher, so we're having to pay out more and we have to increase our premiums. And everyone is swallowing that without asking if the people that are in fact dying from despair and suicide are in fact the ones that have life insurance policies in the first place. So there's a lot of obfuscation about various facts that are being proposed. And of course, we've seen plenty of examples of that as well from lots of companies that import, where they've said that shipping rates are 10 times higher than they're used to paying. And I don't know how many times I've heard people repeat the exact same story to me about how they used to be importing and pay a couple of $1,000s for their container, and now it costs $50,000 or $35,000 or $40,000. And you can pick a number that's a multiple. But it's usually a 10 times multiple, and that is just simply no longer true. But it has been used as a rationale for raising prices. So we're in an environment where prices are rising, and it will start to encourage new supply into the system. And if we get greater geopolitical tensions, there's the potential that we get a spike higher. But high prices will inevitably eventually encourage new supply into the market, but it may not be OPEC supply. And if that's the case, it could be more from Brazil, more from offshore, and that is obviously then going to create demand for services. And a large number of oil service companies in the offshore sector have gone bust. And it means that They have not just lost their businesses, but they've lost expertise. And that expertise is either going to go into other oil service companies, or those people are going to go off and find other things to do. So some of them will obviously have gone to the offshore wind sector. But oil service companies are still trading at a fraction of where they were back in 2014, and they're only just now beginning to break out. So we're not even really at a point where a lot of money is being deployed in new supply. But as prices move higher, it is absolutely inevitable that despite the headwinds in terms of the media, that various parts of the energy sector around the world are going to start to attract capital. And of course, it's not just oil that's doing well. So gold prices were up $32 today, and this is one of the more dynamic weeks we've had in the last year. So there have been occasions in the past where we've got up to this $1,850 area, and twice in the last year they failed. So this is the third attempt to sustain a move above $1,850. We have a clear sequence of higher reaction lows since March, April of last year. This is an 18-month consolidation. Back at the peak in August of 2020, I got a lot of pushback from subscribers when I sold my leveraged gold longs. I'll be the first to admit I probably bought them back too early, and I've been sitting around with a break even, which is around the $1,800 area, for months. And I've had multiple emails more recently from subscribers where people are just giving up and they have lost patience. And I think lost patience with good reason, because gold has been going nowhere and stock markets have been doing particularly well over the course of the last year. So anyone who's been sitting in gold hasn't made any money. And if anyone were in gold shares, well, the chances are they lost money. So it's, I think, reasonable to justify a sense of being ticked off with gold and losing faith in the bull market hypothesis. But I think the important point here is that we have an extraordinarily lengthy base. So gold shares did a lot of nothing for 7 years and then broke out. And now they're consolidating. And a first step above the base can last for anything from months to a couple of years. But the most important thing about a first step above the base is that higher prices are sustained for the medium term. Because there were 7 years where nobody was willing to buy the gold miners ETF above $30. And now, every time it has come back to $30, people view it as value. So we're in an environment where past resistance has become future and current support. And I think that we're now back in a value situation, because investors are beginning to watch gold breaking back above the $1,850 area. So there is certainly the potential here that the strife in Russia might be the catalyst for additional interest in the gold sector, and certainly more interest in physical commodities overall. And CF Industries was another one of the better performers in here today. And of course, it's a fertilizer company. So now we've got to look at plenty of back history just to get some perspective on where prices were back in 2008, now in a big recovery in 2015, and now breaking out to new all-time highs. It's one of the better performers overall in terms of the agriculture sector, and Mosaic completing its base formation in here this week and pushing on to new highs. So there's a lot of interest in the commodity complex because as we look at what's going on in the technology sector, the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is, well, at the peak, at the beginning of this year, it was over 40% overextended relative to the 1,000-day moving average. And now it's encountering resistance in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range and the region of the 200-day moving average. So there's the real potential here that we're looking at scope for a full reversion back down to the 1,000-day moving average, which would unwind the post-pandemic advance. And just putting a more bullish shine on this, this isn't unreasonable that we had a bust and then a really big recovery boom, and now we get some hangover in the form of inflation and some of those bills that were left unpaid, or I guess during the party there was a card put behind the bar and a large tab was taken out on it, and now that bar tab is going to have to get paid. So we're moving into a period of less aggressive growth, less aggressive spending, and a period where inflationary pressures are going to be brought back down. And the Federal Reserve has a couple of different ways of doing that. And central banks all over the world are following pretty much the same suite of policies. Well, the first thing they can do is raise interest rates. So that raises the cost of capital. And then they can also stop buying things. So then that removes the support from the bond market and pushes up yields. And of course, what that also does is it reduces demand for speculative assets. So you get a stock market correction, and that helps to hit some of the really bullish sentiment. So people start buying less stuff, and by buying less stuff, it reduces some of the inflationary impetus. They've also said that when they are going to begin the balance sheet runoff, they're going to prioritize selling their mortgage securities. And of course, that means that mortgage rates would increase, and mortgage rates have increased. And we're right at the upper side of the range of spreads over treasuries. So, around 2% is generally about as high as it goes, but in extreme circumstances where we get crashes, then it can go higher. But this is going to start to contain some of the upward pressure on mortgage rates. So, I think that's an important factor. So, these are the kinds of measures that central banks are deploying. Well, the Bank of England has already raised rates a couple of times, and the ECB is reluctant to raise rates. They are terrified of derailing the economic expansion, and they're extremely unlikely to raise rates when there's the risk of greater geopolitical tensions. So I think that's certainly an important factor. And it's helping to support the dollar. So the dollar index was in positive territory today, and we've had a failed downside break, a failed upside break. Now we're bouncing from the lower side of the range. I think it's quite likely that the dollar is going to push higher from here as long as we have a flight to quality going on. And I think it's particularly relevant here. This ratio I created of the Fangman plus Tesla shares, it's been quite volatile over the course of the last few weeks, and it's still around the 20% level. But We've had bounces from the 200-day moving average, big declines, big bounces, and today was another big decline. So the eight shares that have constituted the best performance and the majority of the strong performance on the Nasdaq over the course of the last decade are now underperforming the total market and falling faster than than the wider market. We can think about Apple and the fact that it rebounded impressively following its strong earnings. The one thing that I don't think seemed to get any commentary in the media was that every one of those companies that reported strong earnings off cloud, their guidance wasn't nearly as bullish. So now we're starting to see some of the enthusiasm coming back out again. And it's worth reminding ourselves that these companies are not immune from pullbacks, but they have done spectacularly well. Even at today's price, Apple is three times higher than it was at the lows in 2020. And it has a history of pulling back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And that's a big decline from where we are right now. And these are the companies where a great deal of savings and money has been concentrated. So Microsoft is closing out the week below the 200-day moving average. And the buy-the-dip share of the last decade has been Amazon. So we've seen a big decline, and now we're starting to see resistance coming through in the region of that 200-day moving average. This looks like a bearish chart. It looks like a completing top formation. And until we have clear evidence to the contrary, then that has to be the base case. Then when we think about the semiconductors index, well, it did really very well, and now we are seeing it also encountering resistance here. AMD, which had rebounded impressively earlier this week, is starting to give it back up again, and it was down. It was one of the leading decliners in here this week. ASML, which has been one of which I've seen spoken about in terms of companies that never go down, has clearly broken its sequence of higher reaction lows and is extending its decline below the 200-day moving average. Now, there is absolutely no questioning the fact that the kinds of machines that ASML produce are one of a kind. They don't have major competitors, and it's truly amazing the kind of technology that they produce. And we have spending plans from just three companies: Intel with $20 billion. You have Taiwan Semiconductor talking about $40 billion, and Samsung talking about $38 billion in spending for new factories this year. So $100 billion in spending for new semiconductor and memory factories this year, and ASML is starting to come back down. Well, that tells us that the valuation must be really rich, and it's trading at an estimated PE of 33 despite the decline, and a price to sales of 12.5. So we're trading in very rich valuation territory. But when we then contrast this with what we're seeing in the luxury goods sector, because luxury goods did spectacularly well during the pandemic, and they attracted massive amounts of money because people who were getting, and I saw this, and I had good friends who work as managers on Rodeo Drive. And one of the comments that really sat with me was that they were seeing people coming into the stores that had never come in before. And there were queues around the corner outside the Gucci store because there was a really happy circumstance where the $600 that people were getting in additional payments every week coincided with the $600 that a pair of Gucci loafers cost. So they were doing phenomenally well. But Hermès International really accelerated at the end of 2021. And now it's given up the entire advance and it's back below the 200-day moving average and coming back down this week in a dynamic manner. So sure, we have short-term oversold conditions, but this is a significant break of trend. It's the biggest decline the share has ever had. And when we look at that on a log scale chart, well, then it also stands out. And it's a long way from the 1,000-day moving average. It could come back by another third and still only approximate the region of that 1,000-day moving average. And again, this is a wonderful company that specializes in creating products that have got a lot of appeal and that people want. But there was a lot of loose money floating around over the course of the last 2 years, and it's looking increasingly likely that that loose money period is over for the moment. Eventually, central banks are going to give up on being panicky about inflation and become more panicky about growth. So, growth rates have not slowed down to any measurable extent just yet. And obviously, they would prefer, or at least they should prefer, to have an inflationary boom rather than an inflationary bust. So, we're in a rather difficult scenario right now because this looks like a medium-term correction. And nothing has occurred yet to really question the fact that it is a medium-term correction. Medium-term corrections can last for anything up to 18 months to 2 years. And it's potentially likely that that's what we're going to see. Now, if that then translates into a major transition where we start to see a lot more interest in cyclical and mining stocks and less interest in the technology sector, then that's going to represent a major transition. But it looks increasingly likely that gold is beginning to turn upwards at exactly the same time that technology is beginning to turn downwards. And that's not at all strange when we compare the experience of what happened in the early 2000s. So, what is it that could contribute to a major gold bull market? Well, I think it really comes back to that big tab that was engaged and spent during the pandemic. Because the way that that money is going to get paid back is in devaluing the currencies. They're uncomfortable with having inflation rates in the region of 7.5%, but they might be happier with inflation closer to 4%. So I think it's much more likely that we're going to start to see some of the restrictions that are being imposed removed when inflation starts to come back down, because whatever they're fearful about inflation, they're terrified of deflation. And the base effect from the big moves in prices we've seen is going to start rolling out, excuse me, rolling off in the second half of this year. So inflationary pressures are going to begin to moderate. We've seen a really significant decline in shipping rates, and the queues of ships outside of ports have begun to ease. But now the question is, what happens with the Baltic Dry Index. It was, I think, a big question. Why did the price pull back so aggressively? And I suspect that a lot of that had to do with China cutting off exports in an effort to clean the air over Beijing for the Winter Olympics. We can see, for example, that the downhill ski slope where they're doing the slalom competition has got these massive cooling towers in the background. Well, obviously, that power station is turned off right now. And it's going to be turned back on again as soon as the cameras leave. So, after the New Year holiday, China has announced a large number of initiatives to support the economy. And China's high yield index has bounced. So I think that's a rather important phenomenon. And when we look at this, it's a price index, and I'm afraid I'm just not permissioned for the yield. But we certainly have evidence here of the loss of downward momentum and big upward dynamics starting to come through. So China is beginning to loosen up the purse strings and begin to lend assistance to the high yield sector. And the property sector has begun to also recover. So the Shanghai Property Index is back above the 200-day moving average and has certainly rebounded from the lower side of this 6-year range. The last thing China wants is to have a property crash. And they want to ensure that growth is coming in around the stated objective of about 5.5%. And they're going to do what's required to achieve those goals. And they obviously also don't want to have social unrest. And that means that they're going to have more electricity production and make sure that people aren't freezing during the winter. So, the commitments to zero carbon and decarbonization overall are getting put on the long finger, and the steel producers were given an additional 5 years to comply with those regulations in here this week. And who's to say that that objective won't get pushed further out in years to come? So, certainly, China is beginning to provide assistance, and that's going to be a source of support for both the commodity complex but also the global economy. And now we're also at a point where Japan is going to have to make a decision because JGB yields are at 23 basis points and have completed the base formation, and without clear action by the Bank of Japan, then this yield is going to move higher from here. And if that's the case, it's going to start putting pressure on Japanese government finances. The yen was a little bit stronger in here today, and a lot of that was to do with just risk off generally. When the dollar, gold, and the yen rally at the same time, it's because people are selling everything else. So JGB yields pushing higher from here. It's putting the Bank of Japan in a bind because they have a stated objective of keeping the yield below 10 basis points. So they're going to either have to intervene or abandon it because they're losing credibility the higher this yield goes. And that also represents a potential source of additional new liquidity coming into the market. Countries like Japan and the ECB, they've got significant challenges in terms of raising interest rates. And I think during this cycle, we're going to see the same challenges being faced by the USA. Everyone was talking about the Japanization of the US markets immediately after the credit crisis. And didn't pay too much attention to the fact that it was in fact Europe was the region that was being Japanized in terms of interest rate policy. And now the question is, and everyone is assuming that interest rates are going to move higher. You have Goldman Sachs talking about interest rates rising 7 times this year. Well, they're assuming that every hike would be 25 basis points, but it implies a minimum increase of 175 basis points. Well, one thing that's particularly interesting right now is that the yield curve spread, when we look at the 10-year and the 2-year, is contracting rapidly. It's down to 43 basis points. 2 weeks ago, it was at 75. So we've had a really quite impressive contraction. And it's quite possible that we're going to get an inverted yield curve within the next couple of months. But when we look at the original yield curve spread, the 10-year minus the 3-month, we haven't had the same movement. In fact, at the same time that the 10-year minus 2-year has been advancing, the 10-year minus 3-month one has been contracting, the other one's been advancing. So 3-month yields have only really just started to move. And it's inevitable that if interest rates do rise, well, then the 3-month is obviously going to have to move higher as well. And we're up to about 34 basis points right now. That's only pricing in the potential that interest rates rise a little more than 25 basis points. So in other words, it's giving a 50% probability that, or actually less than a 50% probability that interest rates will move by 50 basis points in March. But as that short-term interest rate rises, then it will put downward pressure on the yield curve spread, and it will play catch up with the 2-year minus 10-year, or the 10-year minus the 2-year. So we can think that the longer dated one is offering a lead indicator for the shorter or the wider spread. Except for the fact that that's not usually how it happens. It's usually the case that the 10-year minus 3-month becomes inverted first, and it tends to give a better lead indicator for future recessions. So what this is in fact really suggesting is that investors are worried about inflationary pressures over the longer term, but they're still willing to give the benefit of the doubt to disinflationary forces in the near term. And it's when that starts to change, it's usually you get an inverted yield curve when it's exactly the opposite. When short-term interest rates are higher, it's implying that inflation's a near-term problem, and longer rates start to become depressed because people are starting to price in the potential there will be a recession, and therefore there's less risk of inflation in future. So when that 3-month yield continues to rise and we start to get in de facto interest rate hikes and people willing to price in greater potential for more interest rate hikes in future, well then that version of the yield curve spread is going to contract violently. So it's quite likely that we could be looking at a recession at some point in 2024. Because an inversion of the yield curve is a lead indicator of for anything from about 6 months to 18 months. Now, we're also looking at the correction on the stock market. And it's worth reminding ourselves that the stock market is a lead indicator. So it's one of the most reliable lead indicators for future growth. And with stock markets pulling back, it's pricing in less growth in future. I anticipate that the Federal Reserve will be forced to re-engage with its quantitative easing programs when the market pulls back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. But I do not anticipate that they're going to relent until there's a significant decline in prices and clear evidence that growth is moderating, and mostly that, and most importantly, that speculative activity is being curtailed, particularly in the property market, because property prices ramped higher last year. And what happens in terms of Bitcoin is, I think, also rather important, because the price, just like some of those semiconductor shares, rebounded really impressively and got right up into the region of that 200-day moving average and then pulled back rather sharply in here today. So we've had 2 days on the downside, and it was down almost $1,000 on Friday. So it's ticked over now into the Saturday trading. And it did rally enough to break the sequence of lower rally highs and that downtrend from the peak in November. So this was certainly evidence of some dip buying coming through in here. And how well it can hold that low is going to be very telling in terms of the demand for alternative assets and Bitcoin's ability to act as a safe haven. Because over the course of the last 6 months, it has acted a lot more like a risk asset than a safe haven asset. And when we see safe haven assets like the dollar, the yen, gold, and oil all advancing and Bitcoin falling on a day, well, then that, I think, really does help to ram home the point that this is a risk asset. And if we see a deeper pullback coming through on the growthy portion of the market, well, then it's likely that we're going to see a significant decline in Bitcoin as well. Now, we've all become really interested in technology over the course of the last decade. And I get newsletters every day from New Atlas and from Futurism, and there's a couple of others as well that come out on a less prolific basis. And I've seen that one of the chaps that used to be at Andreessen and Horowitz is now producing a newsletter for technology and investing. And this has become a really interesting sector and with holding lots of promise. And the Strachery newsletter is also one that's it come out over and become very popular over the last decade. So that's also evidence of lots of interest and lots of things to talk about and really exciting things happening in the technology sector. And lots of exciting prospects, and the pace of innovation is undeniable, and the application of artificial intelligence and deep learning and the advances in algorithms for dealing with vast quantities of information, and the fact that Facebook now has one of the fastest supercomputers in the world that just went online. Well, these are all facts, but it doesn't mean that the valuation is justified. So Facebook is pulling back in an extraordinarily dynamic manner, and it was down again in here today, and it's now below the 1,000-day moving average. And this is a share that has completely unwound the pandemic advance. So as a lead indicator, it may be one of the ones that finds support first. But then we also have other companies that have pulled back in exceptionally aggressive fashions. So PayPal continues to decline, and it's been pulling back in an aggressive manner for 6 months already, and it's also completely unwound its pandemic advance. Now, this is not a company that is unprofitable. PayPal has free cash flow in the region of about $5.5 billion. But unfortunately, it's against an enterprise value of $133 billion. So it does have free cash flow. It just doesn't have enough of it to justify the valuation. And that's what we're starting to see happening to a lot of these companies, that even the ones that do have profits, well, those profits are so small that they just can't possibly keep up with interest rates. And then, of course, we have lots of companies that do not have profits, and they're going to come back even more. But what it also means is that there will be buying opportunities. And when we see these companies that have pulled back extremely violently begin to find support, well, then that's going to be, I think, a multi-year or a once-in-a-decade opportunity to buy techie-type companies at really attractive valuations, but it's going to winnow the field a lot. There are going to be huge numbers of companies that run into really big problems as liquidity starts to become less available. And it means that we will need to see clear evidence of support building before we can have confidence. Now, in a crisis type situation, every company is going to experience pressure, and some will bounce first, and it's those that bounce first will be the leaders in the new technology cycle. And there will be a new technology cycle. The demand for automation is going to increase significantly with inflation, because companies are going to be clearly incentivized to use fewer people. And that will also help to improve productivity. So it's not like we're at the end of a secular bull market, but some of the excess that's built up over the last 5 years is certainly being eroded right now. And it's creating value opportunities in technology, even as we see these accelerations lower. It's worth reminding ourselves that companies like Google didn't IPO until after the tech crash in the early 2000s, and that companies like Amazon were breaking out to new all-time highs in 2009. So relative strength in an environment where we have really significant corrections in a whole sector is indicative of real strength. And there will be buying opportunities in the technology sector, and they're going to be really strong performers in the recovery. But unfortunately, we're not there yet. And we're not at a point yet where there's a relenting attitude from central banks, because they're panicking about inflation. And then against that background, we have we have central banks that are looking at debts, and we have governments that are attempting to appease restive populations. You have I think what has surprised a lot of people is just how organized the truckers have been in Canada, and you have the Freedom March of Truckers now in France as well. So copycat organizations. We're increasingly getting to a point where people are sick to death of lockdowns and being told how to live their lives. And that is something that I think governments are probably going to have to deal with, because in democracies there will be elections. And ultimately, elections will just put people in power that will give the people what they want. So we're going to see a more libertarian environment overall. And we're going to see greater demand for commodities because of I think regardless of libertarianism, people remain worried about the climate. They're worried about the volatility that's occurring, and they want to see solutions. So some of the solutions will be taxation oriented, and that's going to contribute to higher costs overall, particularly from carbon emissions. And there will be demand for technological solutions in the form of efficiency gains. So that's obviously going to be one of the big trends in future in terms of efficiency of demand for energy. And we're likely to see greater demand for efficiency gains in the production of commodities, because commodity prices could potentially break out. And soybeans is pausing right now in the region of the upper side of this very lengthy range. And it's short-term overbought. So we could easily see a good-sized consolidation in this area. But the drought in Latin America hasn't broken. And the changing climate conditions, where we have vineyards migrating in places like France because the south of France is becoming too hot. Well, this is not something that is going to be fixed quickly. It means that growing conditions are changing and yields are becoming less predictable. And that suggests that food prices are going to continue to rise, so that we could start to see agricultural prices breaking higher. And again, this isn't something that's likely to be solved by interest rates, but it is really seriously inflationary, and particularly for the lower strata of society. And that's only going to contribute to greater social unrest. So I think the inflationary theme is very much with us. And we're very similar to situations like we had in the early 1970s, because the seeds for the inflation in the 1970s were sown in the 1960s. And that's exactly what we've had over the last 4 or 5 years. And we're going to reap the fruits in terms of inflation going forward. So that's positive for commodities. It's positive for real assets. And it's also particularly positive for technology that can try to deal with some of those problems. I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.